Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the New Books Network. My name is Lee Pierce, she, they pronouns. I am a visiting assistant professor at the State University of New York at Geneseo. And I am delighted today to have with me Leslie Honor, author of To Become an American, Immigrants and Americanization Campaigns of the Early 20th Century, published by Michigan State University Press in 2017. This is a really fabulous book. It's essentially an overview of all of the ways that post-turn of the century, pre-World War II, Americanization campaigns in the United States basically created what it is that we think of as the norms of patriotism. In some ways, the book is a history of the present, because some of the traditions that we look at today as being almost embedded in the fabric of what it means to express being an American and what it means to express yourself as being an American have come to be. But in other ways, it's a very deep rhetorical history that looks very specifically at the things that were unique to the time period that the book covers, which is roughly, you know, very early 1900s through about 1920. It talks about issues such as the eugenics campaign, urban housing, and a variety of other things that I found quite fascinating because in some ways they're so similar to how we think about American patriotism now, but also so different because they're unique to the time periods that the book explores. In particular, the book is a rhetorical history because it looks specifically at the various tropes and figures through which Americanization campaigns flourished and also inevitably failed to do what they set out to do. This is something that Honor describes as a paradox of Americanization, and we'll talk more about during the interview. It's also a wonderful work of visual rhetoric, because even though it explores traditional tropes and figures such as metalepsis and synecdoche, it also does wonderful things with some of the images taken from the Library of Congress around the early 1910s with immigrant textbooks, campaigns and parades, and certainly will please both scholars of visual and written rhetoric and everything in between. So I'm excited to get the interview started. Leslie, are you there?
I'm here. Hello.
Hi. And can I call you Leslie?
Absolutely. And she, her pronouns are perfectly wonderful.
Wonderful. Well, do you want to tell us a quick bio, where you are right now, what you do, and then maybe a little bit about how the book came into being?
Yes. So I am an associate professor at Baylor University in the Department of Communication. I started working on this book, one of the chapters, while I was still in graduate school. And then slowly over many, many years, I started doing more archival research as it related to Americanization. And then Marty Medhurst, who happens to be my colleague here, took me out to lunch one day and said, "You need to make this into a book. I would really like to see it when it's done." And we went from there.
Awesome. Well, thank you. That was a great succinct timeline. I love that. Well, we're excited to have the book finally in our hands. I mean, I sort of have seen this project. You were a few years ahead of me in grad school, so I've sort of seen this project emerge. So it's cool to finally see the book come to be. All right. Well, I wanted to start with some of the case studies from the book because I think that'll dive into some of the central thematics that you get into throughout. And I wanted to start with Flag Day. So you talk about, what was it, 1915? You talk about Flag Day as part of, is that the Woodrow Wilson presidency?
Absolutely.
Yep. And then you also end the book, which, you know, good, nice psychological closure there. So I thought we'd start there as the bookmarks on either end is a great way to enter into the project. So do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So we don't often think much about Flag Day today. It's not a very, you know, big holiday for most Americans. I think there's a Simpsons episode where they make fun of Flag Day. I had friends who got married on Flag Day based on that Simpsons episode. But Flag Day is this holiday that was originally created during Woodrow Wilson's administration to do several different things. One, it was part of his pro-war effort so that Americans would get behind the war effort. But for my purposes, what was really fascinating about it was that he made it this spectacle for immigrants, both to like feel what it meant to be patriotic and what it meant to be included in the nation, but also to demonstrate to people who were passing by that that immigrants were in fact patriotic and loyal, right? So during the midst of ramping up into our involvement in World War I and in the midst of international conflict, there was this massive concern that immigrants would be loyal to their countries of origin. And so Flag Day became this holiday to showcase just how loyal those immigrants were. So in New York, my favorite one is New York, where they installed these giant pillars into a ballroom. They had bunting and patriotic symbols everywhere. And then they had this enormous electric sign that said absolute and unqualified loyalty to our country. And the marchers would have to march in front of this giant sign and through all of these throngs of people who would see them and see them as loyal potentially. At least that was the design according to Wilson. And so now, over time, Flag Day has diminished in its spectacle, but for many, many years, that was the basis of its design, was to be this holiday that showcased the greatness of the American citizenry, the loyalty of those who had just arrived here, as well as what we should be doing as Americans to celebrate this country.
Yeah, the word spectacle is really interesting there, because you talk a lot in the book about sort of this paradox of these kinds of displays in that they are sort of very ostentatious, and it's kind of, they sort of operate under this logic that like the more visibly American you are, the more American you must be. So kind of this very superficial logic that more ornamentation is better. But of course, also that logic really never takes hold, because no matter what, there's always this suspicion that, well, they could just be performing. So do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yes. Yeah, so first I want to talk about like this historical shift to more display.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
Mm-hmm. So at earlier points in history, so the early part of the Republic, it would have been considered a good idea to be a patriotic American and to feel like internally your emotions of dedication to the nation. But displaying those emotions would have been seen as artificial, right? And so you think about that artificialness as problematic, because who was included in the nation at that time would have been seen as like the forefathers of the Republic. I'm air quoting right now. But right, this idea here is that over time, newcomers to the nation create this injunctive to say, no, we need to see that you're patriotic. And so by the time we get into the early teens in the 20th century, what we have is a set of, no, you need to wear a flag pin. No, you need to dress a particular way. You need to fly the flag. You need to have a 4th of July celebration that looks a particular way. You can't drink on the 4th of July, for instance. And all of these things go into the holiday because that notion of display is so important, so that newcomers have some kind of model of Americanness to embody. But of course, the visual component of that is always paradoxical, right? So part of it is that even anytime immigrants tried to embody this notion of Americanness, there's always commentators, everyone from people in Congress who are proposing immigration exclusion to commenters in newspapers who are discussing whether or not the Americanization movement deserves funding or resources, right? They're simply suggesting over and over and over again, you don't know what their real feelings are, and they're just playing as Americans. And I think that that paradox, and I argue, right, that that paradox continues to motivate how we think about the display of patriotism, that it becomes all-encompassing and all-important, and yet it's become untethered from emotions and any kind of authenticity, right, as symbols are wont to do. And that creates this sort of weird environment where we demand the symbols, and yet there's no way to determine what's actually there.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating, because one of the things I love about this book, which I'm sure people have told you, is that you don't, since I'm not a historian of this period or these particular rhetorical performances, I never knew that this had not always been a thing. I mean, intellectually, I sort of knew we couldn't have always been like so obsessed with the flag, but I didn't really understand that these are very much, even though they feel very real and very much tied to how we think of ourselves as Americans or how we judge other people, they're in fact rhetorically constructed. It's just they're rhetorically constructed with a really long timeline. So we've kind of lost the trace of the point at which these were produced instead of just habits. And so it's a really cool book, especially when you think about all the stuff going on now with, like, I'm sure, like, Colin Kaepernick not kneeling. And it really kind of, for me, it sort of unsettled a lot of things that I took for granted as being just part of the deal of American patriotism. And then in turn, that, of course, makes them up for negotiation in a sense.
Absolutely. So I think about the case of the young man in Florida who wouldn't say the Pledge of Allegiance. Right. And the substitute teacher called the police on him.
Was this the kid who wouldn't say it because he was gay?
No, he wouldn't say it because it was the civil rights struggle functionally.
Oh, OK. Because there was another one a couple years ago with a kid who wouldn't say it because of LGBTQ. All right. OK. So it happened a couple times then. All right.
And so when I'm reading this story and I talk about this example with my students, because there's always some example of a student or someone refusing a patriotic ritual, right? And so we talk about this example and they're saying, well, why wouldn't you say the Pledge of Allegiance? And I'm like, well, it's not that old, right? We didn't all start doing this until World War I. And even then, it wasn't the same pledge. Right. And so you have the Women's Relief Corps or the Daughters of the American Revolution changing the wording of the pledge lots of times to make it what it is that we know today. And yet we see that as something that like Benjamin Franklin would have done, which is absurd and never happened.
That's really good. Yeah. That's actually a good segue. I wanted to talk about the Obama flag pin, because even though this is a work of rhetorical history, I'm just thinking that for the audience at home who hasn't read the book yet and might be coming to this with like sort of very 21st century eyes, that it might be good to start with another modern example, and then we could move more into the historical piece, because I think you do a good job of bridging them, although I do appreciate how much this remains rooted in history and doesn't keep jumping forward, because it's hard to be like to do sustained historical analysis. And I'm not surprised that Marty Medhurst loved this book, because it is just like right up his alley.
Yes. So one of the parts that I talk about in the book is the sort of creation of flag pins. So those began to be popular actually at the end of the war. So 1924 Flag Day is when we start to have, you have to wear a flag pin on your lapel. Prior to that, if you had forgotten your flag pin, historical discourse has said you could wear it in your heart. Whereas now we have this political injunction that if you are wearing a flag pin, you love the country. And if you don't wear a flag pin, you're obviously a communist who's going to, or, you know, a secret Muslim or whatever, right? That's going to wish the nation's demise. Well, that came to a head both during Obama's senatorial run and then during the 2012 presidential run, where during his senatorial run for Illinois, he said he wasn't going to wear the flag pin because it was a false patriotism, right? And so many people are cheering that because it's become so ubiquitous. It's almost as though you're not even thinking about what the symbol means anymore or how that relates to how we run the country, right? All of these different actual practices of governance. He got so much backlash for that simple comment that quickly he changed his practices, right? And you see him start showing up with the flag pin, right? And so if you look almost any Snopes website or almost any Know Your Meme website, anything that catalogs these very mundane practices, right? You'll see that there are a ton of images and there are a ton of public discussions where if you're wearing a flag pin, you love the country. And if you're not, you don't. With Obama, that becomes a cipher for racism, right? Because what's happening is he doesn't embody, at least it, certainly in 2012, the kind of person we think the president should be, right? At least the types of people who see the president as a white guy, right, are going to react strongly against President Barack Obama running for president at the time, right? So when that happens, it becomes a way to distinguish he's an outsider, he shouldn't be here, because the flag pin is that leverage that they have to highlight that he's playing the role in the same way that playing immigrants as Americans did in the early 20th century. And so if you think about like the backlash against Kaepernick or the backlash against young people not saying the pledge, that articulation of a problem may not actually be about the patriotic symbol, but the patriotic symbol is leverage to articulate that they're playing this role. They're not actually belonging to the country or to the practices of civic life in the way that normative prescriptions would have us typically do.
Well, yeah, and it's a really disempowering position, right? Because the visual display of patriotism, so the flag pin or standing for the pledge or whatever, is not sufficient to prove you're an American.
Right.
But it is sufficient if you don't do it to prove that you're not.
Well, so here's the paradox. You're required to do it, right? If you want to run for office, you better have that flag pin on, but it's still going to be used against you regardless, right? So even when Obama starts wearing the flag pin or when Nancy Pelosi wears a flag pin, it's still a cause of significant criticism, regardless of whether or not, right? So when Obama wears it after he changes his mind, it's evidence that he's a flip-flopper and that he's not really sincere. When Nancy does it, right, there'll be either false claims that she's wearing it upside down or that she is using it to trick us into socialism, right? We also live in a giant world of misinformation. So part of that is how those lies circulate. But notice it's focused on that symbol and how those individuals do not embody what we expect of our governing politicians.
Yeah, I mean, the visual logic here is really, really well done. For the listeners, this book has some terrific images and discussions of visuals that we're just trying to skip over just because without having the images in front of you, it can be very frustrating to listen to two people talk about them. So, but yeah, one of the many reasons to pick up the book on your own and read it after this interview is that you will get more intimately acquainted with the visual critique that saturates the book that's very well done. So let's talk a little bit about this Americanization, because we're talking right now with Obama and Pelosi about sort of like vestiges of this actual concerted campaign throughout the 1910s and into 1920 or so, of an actual specific thing that was called Americanization, which I sort of never knew was its own movement. I mean, I knew about things like we get mad when people don't wear the flag pin, but I just sort of assumed that was kind of always, there were always these different rules that people created. But I didn't actually know until I read the book that there was this specific campaign of which Flag Day is kind of one of the many high points. So maybe you could talk a little bit about that, since sort of the book is essentially a study of these campaigns, not necessarily a study of just Americanization generally practices over the 20th century.
Right. So in the 18th and 19th centuries, you have what would have been called Americanization movements that churches or labor unions or employers would put on to help newcomers to the country learn English, potentially naturalize, those kinds of things. By the time you get to the end of the 19th century, into the 20th century, you have a big shift, and that is war-torn nations and a bunch of economic changes in Europe primarily create a situation where we have a third to almost a half, depending on which statistics you believe, of the country is immigrants. And as we move closer into the 20th century, sociologists who are doing very poor work at this time start to draw distinctions between these newcomers and the quote old stock of people in the United States, and they paint them in these really large stereotypes, right? So at that point, those sort of ad hoc efforts at Americanization start to get ramped up into nationalized efforts. So when Wilson is elected in 1912, right, you have a bunch of different people that come into this. So you have Francis Keller, you have Immigrants in America Review, then Francis Keller becomes the head of the National Americanization Committee. And all of these things come together to create this nationalized campaign that does a bunch of different efforts. So they work on public schools as a, quote, laboratory for nationalism. You have federal programs that are rolled out to employers. You have a bunch of different strategic efforts to specifically Americanize laborers, especially for the war effort. And then children are the other sort of target audience. There are some other target audiences, so mothers who would remain at home and wouldn't have interacted with those lesson plans, which is actually kind of false because those mothers would have been employed anyway, but that's neither here nor there. So all of these campaigns come together and they create this nationalized campaign that becomes almost an all-encompassing effort, right? So a newspaper author from 1919 writes that something along the lines of only an agile and determined immigrant could escape Americanization lessons of the many planned for him.
That's interesting. So what do you make of that statement?
I mean, I get the 1916 election of Woodrow Wilson. Just wanted to clarify that he was elected in 1916.
Trust me, if there's somebody who's going to check your presidential election date. 1954. I'm like, yeah, that sounds right. You're right. Woodrow Wilson, sure.
1916. Anyway, so the point of this is all of those lessons get ramped up for two different audiences, really, right? So historians typically think about Americanization as a rhetorical set of materials that shaped how immigrants understood the nation, right? And that's sort of the primary focus, but it's also something that's reflected towards the general populace, right? It's also teaching all Americans what it means to be that thing and how to enact that in their everyday lives. And so all of these symbols of patriotism or even rituals of patriotism seem natural to us because of this massive, overwhelming, everyone would have been involved in this or at least have known about it during that time period.
Yeah, you've got a great quote on page 179 in the conclusion. And obviously I'm reading this I'm reading it to the audience to let them know how well written the book is. I'm not reading it to you because I think you don't know your own quote. As a rhetorical pedagogy, the lessons of Americanization progressed inductively from individual to the nation writ large. The stimulation of the visual supposedly arrested the pupil and opened the pathway toward a deeply felt patriotism. Later lessons were to demonstrate to the public that Americanization was an effective pedagogy. It could create Americans capable of being identified as such. The goal then was not merely to change immigrants, but to manufacture a set of pedagogical lessons that could both teach immigrants to see themselves as Americans and to transform the ways the public apprehended Americanism. And I think that that's sort of what you're talking about here. And I think it's an important lesson to remember that the Americanization campaigns were as much about making the people into Americans as it was making immigrants into Americans. And so sometimes we forget and we think that like Americans are just already obvious and it's the immigrants we have to bring into the fold. But every time we're trying to say like, oh, we're trying to Americanize the immigrants or something of that nature, it's really also us, which is to say, in a sense, none of us are really Americans to begin with, which I think is an important point the book makes.
Exactly. That this is not an inherent condition. It's something that's cultivated, and we can cultivate it in helpful ways or we can cultivate it in particularly toxic ways.
Yeah. Have you read Kendall Phillips's book on pre-horror films, Place of Darkness? Oh, so similar type of thing, right? That the way in which the horror movies both sort of are meant to assuage immigrant anxiety, but also bring Americans, quote unquote Americans, you know, without the quotes, into like their full expression of themselves. I mean, yeah, I see a lot of parallels between that argument and this, although they're done in very different ways. Very cool. Yes. He was on the show a couple weeks ago, so Hopefully people have heard that interview. If not, you can listen to that one when you're done with this one.
It was a very good interview.
These are both great books. I mean, I knew our field just produces great books.
I agree entirely.
Yeah. Okay. So, but yeah, so just to sort of, but then it ends, right? Americanization sort of in an interesting way kind of ends, even though it doesn't really end. So you want to talk a little bit about how sort of like the ending of that time period, and then maybe we'll dive into some case studies.
Right. So most of us are probably familiar that 1924 is a watershed year in terms of how the nation handled immigration, right? So
had literally no idea until
okay.
I read this book.
All right.
I am so woefully undereducated, apparently.
That's fine. So 1917 and 1924 are the two key years that set up pretty much the immigration policy we have now, right? There are some changes, but basically it sets up a quota system. Right. So 1917 is important because we exclude all Asian immigration. Right. So it sets up a racial standard that's obviously horrible. But what it also does is it sets up a quota system because Teddy Roosevelt caveats out certain nations that would have been understood as Asian for trade purposes.
Ah, so okay. Similar to what we saw last 2 years of Trump, too. So this
exactly. Exactly. 1924, they model a sweeping immigration exclusion bill on that 1917 action. And so any nations that are left that can immigrate, they take the 1910 census and then information from the 1920 census, and they set up percentages from each nation that can immigrate. And then they exclude even more places based on that. And most of the debate for setting up that immigration exclusion is heavily, heavily predicated on who would fit in to what we've already got here and, quote, who looks like an American in your mind's eye. Right. And even the people who are resisting this legislation, they still fall into this trap of like, no, immigrants are good because they're like us and they can prove that they're like us. And there's very few people that resist the bill wholesale. They simply want to add more percentages, right? So it's already a really narrow understanding. But basically, 1917 and 1924 set up the quota system that we have. And it's, I mean, if you want to really do comprehensive immigration reform, you've got to go really far back.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Jeez, that's a century old at this point.
Exactly. So all of that sort of sets up this time period where Americanization is no longer seen as necessary for a couple of different reasons. One, we've closed the borders, so we don't need it as much, and we think that schools and the natural progression of time will do it sufficiently. And two, we see immigration as a failed endeavor because of this whole concept that those immigrants were simply playing as Americans. And so they'll bring up things like German citizens of the United States who remain loyal to Germany, or internment of German Americans and socialists as evidence that they were disloyal. So we interned, just side note in case anybody doesn't know this, during World War I, we interned 6,000 immigrants and or citizens for supposedly two different reasons. One, if they had ties to war-torn nations that were our enemies and they lived anywhere near a military base or owned a radio, anything that could make an explosive, which could be bleach, mind you. And if they were socialists and anti-war, sometimes they also got interned. And so all of those sort of evidence were brought to bear to say, all right, we're not going to do Americanization anymore. We're not going to give any resources or funding for that, even though employers and schools and a bunch of different organizations still continued to do very similar lessons.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccoli,
zucchini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, I mean, and that sounds like a precedent that's been set up now for a while, that we're just going to assume that someone else is taking care of things that we need to have done. Although, I mean, I guess it's debatable if Americanization necessarily needs to get done.
I'm pretty sure it doesn't.
Pretty sure it doesn't. All right. So let's dive in then. So now we kind of have a time period carved out. We kind of understand that you at some point make the comment that Americanization, even though the campaign sort of officially ended, they weren't swept into the dustbin of history.
Yes.
Because they still sort of with the flag pin. Yeah. The legacy of the Americanization project is not merely jettisoned into the dustbin of history. Traces of its visual logic appear throughout the 20th and 21st centuries. And then we get into the Obama pin thing. So that kind of sets us up then to maybe dive into some of the case studies now that we sort of know where we are historically. And I thought we'd actually start with the one that's at the end of the book on the Campfire Girls and the Girl Scouts.
Sure.
And all I could think while I was reading this chapter, do you watch Bob's Burgers?
I do not.
Okay. Humor me. And if I send you a link to the Thunder Girls episode, which is the fake Girl Scouts that they have.
Okay.
Watch it. Because it just, you know, them mocking, it's like The Simpsons, right? When they mock some of these practices, it really sort of really makes your point in the book very salient that this is definitely true. All right. But let's talk about the actual Girl Scouts and the Campfire Girls, which I knew about this because you published an essay about it a while ago. So it was cool to see its new manifestation in the book. But obviously for people listening, it may be that they've never encountered either the Campfire Girls. Probably they know what the Girl Scouts are, but the Campfire Girls, I think, adds an extra layer of intrigue to this from a historical perspective. So you want to chat about that?
Sure. So Campfire Girls and Girl Scouts started in the early part of the 20th century, and they were seen as a corollary to the Boy Scouts. So they wanted to do the hiking and the camping and all of those different activities. But as soon as they started doing those things, the Boy Scouts and other organizations similar to them started really criticizing those organizations for trying to make girls into Boy Scouts. And so the gender dynamic of that was like, how dare you turn girls into boys? And what happened was a series of shifts in both of those organizations to try and teach domestic lessons at the same time. So you would have things like you'd get a sewing badge, or you would make a campfire, but you would tend food on it, right? So they would domesticate those lessons as they also taught things like hiking, which they called tramping at the time.
No. So,
yes, they called it tramping. Which is my favorite thing to say, like, say all the time. I just want
to. I'm going to use that for so many purposes now. That's such a great word.
I agree. So what happens is the Girl Scouts is actually a really small organization in the beginning of the 20th century, and the Campfire Girls is massive. And so by the time we get to World War I, the Girl Scouts in particular see the war effort as an easy way to help publicize the group. So what they do is they get heavily involved in the war effort, and in particular in the Americanization movement. So both groups were involved. And what they would do is they would, like, their leadership would tell the girls, go out and make a foreign friend and bring her to a Girl Scout or a Campfire Girl meeting so we can teach her how to be an American.
That's amazing.
Right.
Yes. And so that's where you get the title of the book. Right.
Right. So the girl who would become a scout was taught to, like, discard her old world ways and to learn all of these American rituals. And they had all of these, like, cool immigrant girls that they would include in their guidebooks to make those immigrant girls feel like they were part of the nation. They were just like those other immigrant women who had come before them. And then they also had all of these different ways that they thought that the girl would take home those lessons. So if the Girl Scouts and the Campfire Girls could teach her how to make oatmeal for breakfast instead of tea-soaked bread, which is what many Russian immigrants had for breakfast. So if they could teach her how to make oatmeal, then that meant that she would teach both her mother, right, that oatmeal was a proper American breakfast. And then when she grew up, she would ensure that her children had that proper American breakfast, right? So the girl as a figure of the both the past and the future was really central to those efforts.
Wow, that is, oh, you can't even like make this stuff up.
So over time, once they get involved in the war effort, the Girl Scouts in particular, this is where there's a great Library of Congress treasure trove of Girl Scout images that I encourage everyone to go look at, because the Girl Scouts would literally walk in parades wearing long white gowns, showing their purity, carrying flowers, and showing how beautiful and helpful they were. They had pictures of them caretaking of children or sewing for the Red Cross or eating peaches, because peach pits were used in gas masks. So they had all these examples of like the girls saving peach pits or cherry pits so that they could help the war effort. And that plus cookies, don't forget cookie sales start around this time period. That hugely promotes the Girl Scouts. And now families don't have concerns about those girls out tramping in the woods. Right now, they think that the Girl Scouts are a wonderful organization and they want their daughters to join.
Yeah. And gosh, it reminds me so much of when you were probably about the same age. When you were in grade school, did you do was that when the American Dolls came out? Do you remember them?
I do remember American Dolls.
And
each, yes.
And now they're like, now they have so many, but back then there were only the four kinds, and each one of them was specifically part of a war effort.
Right.
And the World War II girl was all about like the rationing. And so even though she wasn't a campfire girl, I mean, that was kind of her whole shtick, was she encapsulated this like figure whose whole entire job was to be as patriotic as possible and sort of bring everyone else into the patriotic fold. And I think what's always interesting about this is that when you think about the suspicion with which we treat like an immigrant who's participating in Flag Day, but like, we're not really sure if it's true.
Right.
You really minimize that skepticism when it comes to these. Of course, that's not true anymore. I mean, you think about all these, you know, child soldiers and stuff, but when you think about the figure of immigrant anxiety is like this little girl putting on all these displays, you tend to, that emotive nationalism tends to be a lot easier to access without the skepticism.
Well, that's true. But that's how the Girl Scouts were kind of using immigrant girls, right? Like if I put them out in front in a Girl Scout uniform, which by the way was made to, the Girl Scout uniform in the early days looked just like the Spanish American War uniform.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Right? You mentioned that in the book, that the way that the uniforms are kind of copying these military.
Right. So yeah. Imagine Girl Scouts standing in a line. You can't tell which one is not, you know, a newcomer in some way or a second generation immigrant. So they all look the same. Or the Campfire Girls had this idea that they wanted all girls to wear these red, white, and blue midi uniforms, and that would save everyone money. But again, the uniform is really important because it presents all members as thoroughly Americanized. And so the immigrant girl is, the figure of her at least, is the figure upon which the Girl Scouts are able to promote their patriotism and domesticity.
Yeah. I mean, no, it's pretty brilliant. That's why I kind of like, even though it's the last chapter of the book, I sort of wanted to start with it because I think it really, for someone who hasn't been through the whole book, I think it really is a great and accessible way to capture some of the primary arguments. Do you want to say anything else about that? And then I thought we'd move on to maybe you pick a case study that we're coming up on about 36 minutes. So we're actually in great shape. But if you wanted to say more about that, or if you wanted to pick another case study from the book that you just think really does a lot of work for the argument or might be accessible to the readers at home, I'd love to see what you kind of think are your favorite spots.
I think my favorites, at least what I love to talk about with my students, are visual aids as part of the Americanization process.
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, so I know that you are a very conscientious and wonderful teacher. When you are in the classroom, what are the technologies that you use that really like grab their attention?
Oh, man, I use a lot. I use Slack.
Okay.
Which is not a visual tech, though. It's more of a communication tech. But for visual aids, I guess I really just use big glossy pic. I like Unsplash, which are these, because I think the really high definition, super crispy images.
Yes.
And I like them full screen and big on the overhead projector. So if I'm going to use it, that's kind of what I, for visual aids, that's where I draw from. And then otherwise, I just kind of use Google Slides to stick them in there.
Right. Well, I do a bunch of different kinds of videos. I embed things. I use PictoChart for the syllabus, right? So that it's like beautiful. And Unsplash is now partnered with PictoChart. So that's fantastic.
Oh, I use Canva for a lot of stuff too.
Oh, yes. Okay. Well, in the early part of the 20th century, teachers of Americanization had that same kind of goal, right? How do I get the students really invested in this lesson? And part of that was that they really thought visual aids would mesmerize the students. And you have to remember, like, a lantern show would have been seen as cutting edge technology.
Oh, right? Yeah. Well, and after reading Kendall's book about the, yeah, and just like how film tech in 1915, I mean, it's really, we're looking at a whole different animal. Same basic intent, right? But just not nearly the options.
Right. Well, also film was highly flammable at this time. Right. So schools would like regularly burn to the ground based on their film stores.
Ridiculous.
Right. So all of this to me is really fascinating for us to think about our technophobia right today, in terms of like, we think that our emotions could be pulled in the wrong direction. And one of the best stories I think from the book is there were riots in San Francisco in 1914. And those riots were based on screening of war footage. It wasn't even actual war footage. It was like random demo war footage that had nothing to do with World War One. And yet there were riots because of the immigrants felt some sort of like compulsion to the homeland, or at least that's what the newspaper coverage said, right? So I love to think about how scared we are of like cell phones and social media use being this toxic poison to young people, rather than something that we can use to help think through, like, how do we think about the emotions in relationship to the visual? How do we think lessons actually impact students? And for me, that's part of how we think about what Americanness is, right? That we're so trapped in the symbols, we rarely discuss, like, how is it that we would like the business or the operations of governing this place actually working? So that's kind of the part that I really like to talk about.
Yeah, that's really neat. So again, another great reason to actually grab the book, even though I think we've done a good job of capturing the main themes, there's always so much more to dive into in the book itself. So, well, I guess with that said, then, I wanted to ask you a little bit then about the textbooks, the Americanization textbooks, because I thought those were really interesting. And also, I think because even though we think of textbooks now as not having this motive, of course, if you read anything about how textbooks are manufactured in Texas, especially where you are, I mean, in some ways, not the Americanization campaign, but textbooks continue to do this work. And so it was cool to me to see the earlier stages of this where we think, oh, that's ridiculous. But of course, no, I mean, this is still work that's being done just in a different mode.
Absolutely.
So I thought we'd maybe finish talking about that and then we can wrap up.
Cool. All right. So there was this group of university professors that comprised what was called the American Viewpoint Society. And what was So side note, most of these professors were also employed by the Committee for Public Information.
Oh, geez.
Right. And so they would write war dispatches, right, to get the American people behind the war effort, since the CPI was largely an engine to do that. But the American Viewpoint Society decided that the way that Americanization was working, which was by largely focusing on emotions, was good, but they wanted the students to get a very strong sense of both American history and, like, if they have a problem, how they can solve it via civic channels.
Mm.
And so they were actually like, they tried to do good lessons. They really did. They failed, but they tried really hard.
We'll give it to them.
So they had a series of textbooks, and they were richly illustrated. Like, I can't imagine how much this cost to produce in the time period.
I thought about that. I was like, oh my goodness, this must have cost a fortune. I was thinking about that myself.
But my archivists were still able to get me copies, so there were enough of them. But each page had images on either side, so that would either like correspond to the lesson at hand. So if it was, here's how you would naturalize, it would like have a picture of the oath of petition, and then it would have pictures of classes and those kinds of items. And the goal, of course, was to allow the reader to see him or herself within the American nation. And so there were regularly pictures of immigrants sprinkled throughout the textbook, because what they wanted, the American Viewpoint Society, right, was to create a viewpoint that allowed immigrants to see themselves as part of this growth of the nation, right? And so they had this melting pot ideology that was clearly manifest in these books that said, if you contribute to the nation in the future, you will see yourself as so much a part of this nation that you will continue this nation's greatness. And if you learn all of like democratic processes, you won't have any problems, because all you have to do is step 1, 2, 3, 4, right? Which is obviously a bit naive, but it was interesting to see them try and address the student as someone who desperately wanted to see themselves in this location, to teach them what that location was, and to also sort of play into that as part of this like forward momentum of trajectory.
Yeah. How did you come across all this? Like, was it just archival research, one thing led to another? Or as you read, did you just notice people mentioning, I'm always interested in people who do rhetorical history, because you're covering such a giant, I mean, 10 years is a lot to cover.
Yes.
You're covering more like 15. How do you pick and choose these few things to focus on that nonetheless kind of create this really awesome overall picture of the time period?
So I narrowed by really focusing on the visual materials that were still available. So some of the stuff just wasn't available. Campfire Girls records burned in a fire. All of the
irony.
The stereoscope cards that the Library of Congress had been stolen in the 90s.
Aww.
Right. So don't steal archival records.
Yeah, for real. That's a real jerk move.
And so I looked at all of the curriculum, and then there were two early pedagogy journals that really printed and talked about all of these materials and what was working and what wasn't working. And then there was a series of educational conferences in DC that also talked about what schools were actually implementing. And so that really helped me narrow down, all right, I don't need to follow random images and lantern shows that were created in Seattle, right? Instead, here are the things that were being implemented in schools. But it took me a long time to get through all the archival research.
I can only imagine.
Yeah,
but it's paid off. It's a wonderful book, and we didn't even talk about the use of rhetorical tropes. But and usually I try to avoid the really deep rhetoric stuff, because I'm not sure how much the listening audience loves that. But each chapter is sort of it's not really a case study so much as it is a certain aspect of Americanization that you're looking at. But it also pairs with a particular rhetorical trope. So I think you do like metalepsis and the Campfire Girls, and you do this great stuff with synecdoche. You said at some point you called it a stained trope in the housing reform movement. Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a lot to dig into. So I don't know if you want to say anything about all of that, but I will say that matching the archival research to the tropes through which you think this particular aspect of the campaign moved, and showing it as sort of something that is both successful and also I think you call it a productive failure, in the sense that it does make Americans out of it, but it doesn't do it without some trace of ambiguity that you really can't make sure and certain that someone is what you think they are on the outside.
Yeah. So I love talking about rhetorical tropes, but I won't get into it too much right now.
You can. I mean, I just, you know, it's always a crapshoot, because it's not like, other than the occasional, we really wish your sound quality were better email. Right. We don't really, it's not like I have a lot of feedback on what people like, so.
I'm just going to say a couple of things about rhetorical tropes that I think are fascinating. One, I think that rhetorical tropes are usually seen as just like ornamentation. And I think that when you position them instead of narratological or even composition-based tropes, when you position them as visual and you start to think about the relationship both between like what you see versus what you don't see, as well as the relationship between identity, like what is supposed to be represented and difference, what is not represented, right? All of that really starts to come together and gel in terms of how do we think about. So let's go back to the flag pin as the example, right? So if I see the flag pin, what I'm supposed to think is patriot. Well, the absence that's being sort of pulled at there is someone who wishes the nation poorly. So in the 50s, that would have been communism. To that today, that might be terrorism, right? All of these absences really start to add up. And I think when you start to dig at tropes, the interplay between that dialectic is really where the work is happening, right? So it's not that Americanization had to work to ever get federal funding or resources. Instead, it just had to create the normative conditions whereby today we think saying the Pledge of Allegiance is ancient history and we all should do it, right? So it has to naturalize that symbol as somehow real while still making it compulsory, even if the people who are saying it in different contexts, right, may or may not be seen as Americans.
Yeah, if I could have a tagline, just based on the interviews I've done so far, if I could have a tagline for the New Books Network channel and language, it would be showing you how stuff you think is real was made up at some point.
Totally true.
Because that's kind of like what we keep coming back to. But I mean, it's really valuable because it's even, and I like the emotional angle. I mean, there's a lot of affect theory and a lot of emotion in this because it is sort of a head heart dilemma because, and again, I wouldn't consider myself like the world's greatest patriot, but it's hard for me not to think about these things as a kind of deep belief. Right. And I really have to work hard to remind myself. I mean, I, you know, like standing up for the pledge and stuff, I don't care about, but you know, even like that thing that happened with Juan Williams a couple of years ago, I guess it was more like 10 years ago at this point, where he said that he gets nervous when he sees someone in traditional Muslim garb on an airplane after 9/11, and that's a conversation we need to have because that's a real fear. He understands it's not rational.
Right.
But it's something that we need to talk about because if not, you have a bunch of people kind of walking around just like suppressing fear. And because it is possible that that visual sign is significant. It's also likely that it's not. And he got fired from NPR
right,
because of the backlash of that statement. But I think about that in the sense of that was him saying, I've been so ingrained with this emotionally through the visual logics through which I've been produced over the 30 or 40 years of my lifetime, that to then tell me it's not true, it takes a lot more than that, right? So in some ways, right, this Americanization campaign shows how much work we have to do if we ever want something else to come into being.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Well,
so,
it was a great book.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, do you have anything else you want to say before we wrap up?
I just want people to sort of think about these symbols of patriotism and either how we might either re-signify things that should be more fitting, or how is it that we can reconceptualize our human relationships in a democratic practice as part of how we think about what being a patriot means or what being an American means. So when I talk to my kids, my own children, about how it is that we celebrate the 4th of July, I want them to understand that fireworks and parades are part of it, but we also talk about history lessons that are important. We talk about all of these things that are broader than just the celebration and the spectacle, because that's also part of it.
Do you remember the scene at the end of Dazed and Confused, or it's at the beginning where they're all leaving for summer break and the hippie teacher's like, remember, because it's right around the whole plot is it's right around, it's the early 70s and the main character, yeah, who's the football guy's trying to decide if he's going to enlist in the draft, even though he objects to the war. And she,
right,
says, so this summer when you're all out celebrating 4th of July, just remember all you're really celebrating is a bunch of dead white guys who didn't want to pay their taxes.
I don't think I'm not the 70s hippie teacher. That's still true. But it's also like incorporating new traditions and practices of patriotism,
yeah,
that you think are central, right? So I see people every year who are going to read What to the Slave is a 4th of July, right?
Yes.
And so I think that could be a very wonderful patriotic practice. I think that teaching history lessons that are not just like dead white guys are bad,
right,
true, but that's not going to build anything for us.
Well, yeah. And I think especially with the refugee, with the mounting refugee crisis, I mean, one of the things that patriotism could start to look like is refugee outreach and bringing them into your homes and sharing meals with them. We have a student right now on my campus who just got a grant to do to bring refugee chefs from across the upstate New York to campus to do dinners on different holidays, not having anything to do with their religion or ethnicity, just picking random holidays. So that instead of having a holiday where we celebrate like Thanksgiving in the traditional sense, it's a Thanksgiving that is specifically kind of perverse or stained by the fact that this person who has no relationship to it the way that we do comes and instead reappropriates that moment to talk about their history and their food. And I always thought that was a really cool idea, especially for an undergraduate to have come up with.
I think that's wonderful. And I think that's exactly the kind of, you know, innovation that we need.
I agree. Well, the first step is obviously getting the book so you can understand where all of these norms came from that you need to challenge. So in that sense, I will one more time say, if you're interested, to please pick up a copy of Leslie Hahner's How to Become an American, which is available from Michigan State University Press from 2017. And very quickly, if you are on a campus that has a library and don't wish to procure a copy of Dr. Hahner's book for yourself, one thing we always encourage is to reach out to your library and put in a purchase request. Libraries purchasing books are one way that we support the university presses and make sure that fabulous books like Dr. Hahner's are available for everyone to take out for years to come and hopefully not burn down in a fire so that in 100 years when somebody else is studying this, Dr. Hahner's book is available for them. So Dr. Hahner, before we sign off, I don't know why I switched to your formal address. I guess it's just habit. So Leslie, before we sign off, do you have a book that you'd like to recommend for an upcoming episode of the New Books Network?
I'm going to recommend two.
I like it.
Okay. The first is shameless self-promotion. So I have co-authored with a former student, Heather Woods, a book entitled...
I love Heather Woods. I didn't know she was the co-author for this.
Yes.
Do you think you could both come on?
Yes, that's the goal.
I love her. Okay, cool.
So that book is called Make America Meme Again, The Rhetoric of the Alt-Right.
So good.
And then the other book I want to recommend is from Carly S. Woods, who is at Maryland, and it's called Debating Women. It is so good.
True story it's about just... Carly S. Woods. Before I ever knew who she was, I randomly found her resume on her CV. That's the academic resume for people who don't know on the internet and borrowed it so I could write mine for grad school when someone told me in 2009 I needed a resume.
There's an entire generation of Iowans who have stolen my CV, which I stole from someone else. So there's a grand tradition.
Yeah, it's true. All right. Well, in that case, I can repay the favor to Carly. All right. Well, look for those two interviews coming up soon. And I will be in touch with you and Heather about getting you on for Make America Meme Again. And thanks again so much. This was a fabulous book, a wonderful interview. And I, again, cannot recommend this book highly enough to everyone listening.
Thank you.
Yeah. Take care.
Bye-bye. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, definitely.